Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get a premium finish with less odor and fumes for your painting project with Rust-Oleum's Low Odor Spray Paint. It provides a long-lasting, durable finish, making it perfect for indoor or outdoor projects. Save big on Rust-Oleum Spray Paints, now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Hey there, this is relationship coach Roy Biancolana, a recent guest on the very podcast that you are about to listen to. Well, get ready and buckle your seats because Aubrey is about to take you on the road to rediscovery with another great episode. Sit back and enjoy.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. Well, here it is. It's official. The Stand Store, our Stand Store, is now officially open. Here you will find anecdotal information supporting your personal growth, from wellness ebooks to free e-guides and more, not to mention the comprehensive Rediscovery Roadmap digital course. That's right, the comprehensive Rediscovery Roadmap digital course. You're going to want to be a part of this. Come visit us at stan.store/road to rediscovery. That's stan.store/road2rediscovery. And as always, we are truly, truly grateful for your listenership. Okay, my special guest is on a mission to humanize the experience of being born transgender. She is a transition mentor and coach, specializing in assisting individuals to navigate significant life changes. With insights drawn from her own experience of transitioning at the age of 67, her podcast, Demystifying the Transgender Journey, was launched, I believe, in early 2024. She can confirm that for us. And she's truly built a judgment-free community of compassion and inclusivity. Let's welcome Wendy Cole to the show. Wendy, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here, Aubrey. This is great.
Well, thank you. I mean, we reciprocate. We're equally excited to have you here and want to just dive right into it, right? What better time than the present?
Absolutely.
All right. So, Wendy, could you please just give us a little context, okay? Set the stage for us by giving us a glimpse into the part of your journey where you encountered, let's say, barriers and obstacles, okay, whether they were brought on by society or whether they were self-inflicted, just from a transition standpoint, and then your discovery of encouragement leading to your transition.
As you so very well stated in the introduction, I was born transgender. There are quite a few pivotal points of my life. By age 3 and 4, I knew who I was. I knew that I felt different. No words for it, no explanation. By age 10, I had been through school, the socialization process from birth to getting to school age. By that time, I knew how I felt was wrong by societal standards. All of the heteronormative standards for men, women, sex, all of that. I just knew that when the teacher said, boys over there, girls over there, I knew I couldn't go where the girls went. Right. Even though that's where I felt I belonged, I had to go with the boys. That struggle faced me until age 10 when I told my parents I was a girl. The result of that will have you committed and fixed. That was a psychiatric facility. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Fishkill, New York, about 40 miles north of New York City. Yeah. There was a psychiatric facility there, five appointments with my parents. And most of the sessions were with my parents, not with me. Children were seen, not heard in those days.
Yes, yes.
It was a very different time. Mm-hmm. And to set the stage, all the way through high school, I was repressing this out of fear of my parents committing me. Mm-hmm. And there was shame and there was guilt and there were all these things going through my mind. And I formed a lot of beliefs in that stage that actually kept me safe for the rest of my life and helped me to repress all these feelings. Mm-hmm. And for your audience's edification, gender is formed in the second trimester of birth, in the frontal cortex of the brain, and it's hardwired and it doesn't change. Just as sexual orientation forms in the second trimester of birth in the amygdala of the brain. And that also is hardwired. None of this is subject to conversion therapy or any of those techniques. It doesn't work. And for much of my life from the 90s on till 2015, I was on a collection of psych meds. Not that I told the psychiatrist this was the condition that I was facing. Because in 1970 and 71, another pivotal point in my life, I decided I couldn't go on. Mm. And I actually tried in that time to transition from male to female. Mm-hmm. I got about 6 months into it. I wasn't living full time as myself, but I was coming out to people. I was doing everything that the psychiatrist that was trying to help me did. One thing he did, which wasn't helpful, he took me to a quarterly meeting of area psychiatrists around Schenectady, Albany, Troy, New York. And I was a case study patient.
Oh, my. Wow.
That lasted for, that meeting was with about 15 to 20 psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. These are MD psychiatrists. And I had no knowledge of what I was getting into at that time.
Right.
I went through university libraries. I did research. I couldn't find much of anything about this. And in those days, I was called a transsexual. And people who today cross-dress were called transvestites. The term transgender didn't exist. In this meeting, after about 3 or 4 minutes, the psychiatrist stood up. "I'll see you all next quarter," looked at me and said, "You're a freak. You should move to New York City and turn tricks like the rest of them."
Oh, my gosh.
That ended the meeting.
How close-minded. My goodness.
But what most people don't realize is in those days, not only were gay people considered to be a psychological condition with no treatment and no cure, so was I. Psychological, no treatment, no cure. My psychiatrist told me that at our next session after that meeting, and he also told me that there was nothing he could really do for me from that point forward. So, and also, too, keep in mind, in those days in New York State, pretty much everywhere in the country and in California, for appearing in public as female, I would be arrested, put in jail, fined, and my name printed in the paper, even in New York City and San Francisco. That was common.
What criminal activity did you commit? It doesn't sound like you committed any criminal activity. Just being who you are?
by societal standards in those days,
yeah,
this was considered illegal. It was a law. It was illegal.
Yeah.
And you were assigned male at birth, and that's all there was to it. So from that point forward, I had always been told by doctors, by my parents, and I was totally gaslighted, which was very possible in those days because we had no cell phones. We had no social media. There was no Google. There was nothing. There was no internet. And so I was told, you're the only one who feels like this. I knew that was BS.
Of course.
Because I knew all about Christine Jorgensen, the World War II vet in the 1950s who came back from Europe after having surgery and everything else in Denmark. I knew all about that. In 1971, I dressed as myself and went to the movie theater to watch the movie Clockwork Orange, fascinated by the fact that Wendy Carlos did the soundtrack to it, and she had transitioned. So after my total failure to transition, I came to the conclusion and the belief, this is beliefs now, I can't do this. I don't have the celebrity status or the means that someone like Wendy Carlos has. So whether that was true or not, that's what I believed, and that's where I stopped, and I drank the Kool-Aid. I got married. I had a wife, and I'd always been told to have a career, so I had my career in tech, which was just starting. And we eventually had a house and two kids. And it didn't fix me. In fact, it made things significantly worse. I wound up, Aubrey, in such stress and chaos and internal turmoil. It's the incongruence between what your mind knows you are and your body and the fact that you have to live this way. Socialization from parents starts the day that that doctor checks between the legs and says, it's a boy or it's a girl. And that's when the socialization starts. So that's why even today, kids who grow up and get to their early teens or mid-teens and finally just come out to their parents, they know what they're going to be facing. But this is a simple fact, too. Anybody in the LGBT whatever world, we don't come out because we're courageous. Mm-hmm. It's for survival.
Mm. Can you repeat that?
We don't come out because we're courageous. We come out for survival. The suicidal ideation from being completely out of the social norms and facing that either repression or isolation is tremendous. It's shattering to a person psychologically.
Wendy, that is so incredibly eye-opening. I can't begin to tell you how much of a revelation that is for me to hear. Okay. And for the benefit of the listeners, that's why I felt it bared worth repeating, mm-hmm. You know, that it's not an act of courage or not out of being courageous, but for survival. To me, in my mind, when you say that, Wendy, that speaks to just the power and the strength of the pressure and the repressing. You know, mm-hmm. and the urge and the need to be who you are,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, otherwise, what else is left? In a lot of cases, suicide or not much. But I mean, you know, you could only go living robotically or programmed so long, you know, and not be to live and not be who you want to be and who you are is not living.
Right. And this is not a choice. That's why I always phrase it as born transgender. It happens in the second trimester of birth. It's nobody's fault. We've always been here.
Right.
This is part of humanity, and it's part of the human fabric. We're a very small portion of society, but we're still part of it. And where the courage comes in, because I've had people tell me, oh, you're so courageous. The courage comes in when you actually face other people.
Yes, living life that way. After the announcement, after sharing or coming out, right?
Right.
It's living because, I mean, that's not the end. It's only the beginning, it sounds like.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you this question, Wendy, and I don't know if it matters. It probably doesn't, but just hypothetically speaking, I just want to know what your thoughts are on this. Earlier, as you were giving us the glimpse into your journey, you mentioned a scientific fact. In fact, I think you mentioned two, and it's what happens, you know, as your brain is formed in the first trimester.
Second trimester.
As you know, as the pregnancy progresses, if there was a way, and I'm not trying to be facetious at all. I truly wonder, you know, in lieu of a doctor looking between the legs to kind of, you know, announce what gender you have, if the doctor had a way of examining that prefrontal cortex or, you know, the amygdala, what do you think they could say, or how would they maybe even explain or express that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, Aubrey, and I don't think that they can do that at the moment. See, the other thing is from 1970-71 when I tried the transition.
Yeah.
And it was considered a psychological condition with no treatment and no cure.
Mm.
Guess when that changed?
When did it change?
2012.
Oh, my.
13 years ago. That's it.
Wow. I mean, you have to wait for a new century to
exactly. And into the new century. Even the first decade of this one, it was still the case.
Wow.
There was an organization, World Professional Association for Transgender Health.
Yes.
They've been lobbying for changing the medical diagnosis for years, and they finally succeeded in 2012. Mm-hmm. That's when we started to see surgeons appearing in university hospitals around the country.
Yeah.
Who could provide the surgeries. People started providing the hormone replacement therapy because that was the new diagnosis. This is treatable now through psychological therapy, hormone replacement therapy, and any necessary surgeries. And all of that's optional to the person going through this. You pick what you need and what you feel comfortable with.
I see.
For me, November 2014 was a big turning point for me. Mm-hmm. I was seriously in pretty bad health, and I'll explain why in a moment. And I was just so disgusted with everything that I was living through. Mm. And I had everything set up to kill myself.
Oh, my.
And the last thing I did was something, I firmly believe this, the universe said, go check your computer. And I checked and I found out the diagnosis had changed in 2012.
Oh my goodness.
I went to my wife.
Yeah.
I said, because we had talked about this in 1978. I was talking in my sleep about being a woman. She woke me up and demanded an explanation, and I told her everything.
Okay.
And I expected to be divorced by morning.
Right.
She decided we would stay together as long as I didn't do anything about this. And I knew I didn't have any options. I said, fine, I'll And we just continued on.
Right.
But it was always there. I perpetually felt guilt and shame for having married her without telling her this. I lied by omission.
I understand. Yeah.
So I had to not only repress all of this, I had to repress and deal with that as well.
Oh my.
And 2015, I had my first therapy appointment where I could actually openly talk to another person. And I'd done a lot of research. I found the right person. I had really good vibes about her profile, her picture. I just felt a real connection with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first intake session was an extended session, and I just poured my guts out for her the entire time. And it felt so freeing and so good to actually talk about how I felt.
Wow, yeah.
And that was the first time in 67 years.
Mm. Amazing.
And she was the first person in my entire life to ever accept me for who I truly am.
Yeah.
Without question, without doubt, and with no need to understand.
Right, right.
I was getting up to leave. This was profound, Aubrey. Mm. She looked at me and said, what's your name? And I snapped back, Wendy. To my joy, she crossed out my male facsimile's name and wrote Wendy on my file. From that day forward, I was Wendy to her.
That is a true definition of an ally.
Yes.
An absolute true definition, and sounds like your introduction to what an ally is.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And somebody who's open to learn.
Yes. Yes.
I saw her for a total of 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think the last three, it was like monthly I would go. Mm-hmm. And she told me after my third year, you don't need to come here anymore. You're fine. Oh,
really? Live your life, right?
Go for it. And I said, no, I, you're my guru. I'm coming in and doing and monthly check-ins just to make sure I'm on track, what I'm dealing with things.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I had learned from her, Aubrey, and this is very important for people going through any significant life change. And I'm talking about things like packing up your whole family in your home and moving to another part of the country to a new career or whatever, or quitting your corporate job and starting your own business. These are all significant life changes. What I learned about a significant life change, like any of those, and in particular this one, which I have to admit is very profound.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
What I learned was, in order to do that, you have to mentally transition. Yes. You have to mentally adjust to whatever that is. Mm-hmm. We all form beliefs. Our beliefs are formed by our thoughts and our emotions.
Yes.
Thoughts are the things that we have daily, the stories we tell ourselves.
Yep.
And those emotions are the mind's way of communicating with the body. Mm-hmm. So that we know, the body knows what we're feeling.
Yes. Yes.
And the hypothalamus puts out neuropeptides, glands throughout the body put out other chemicals. All the chemicals we produce are highly addictive. We're our best drug dealers. And you can become addicted to anxiety, addicted to depression, addicted to all of this. You can also become addicted to your beliefs.
Yes, you can. I see.
And this is the key. You can't live outside your beliefs.
Mm. Yeah, when you stop and think about that, that is very hard, if not impossible, to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the first thing that my therapist, and I credit her for teaching me this, and then I jumped into law of attraction. I also got into Dr. Joe Dispenza for all of this. She challenged all my beliefs, because when I saw her, I still was repressing. I still didn't believe I could do this. She challenged my beliefs. I was journaling. And what I discovered with that is the key to journaling is not writing it all down and not making it look pretty in a notebook or anything.
Right. It's not.
The key to it is going back 4 or 5 days later, reading what you wrote.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided, wow, I don't want to think like this anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't want to feel that way anymore. Those emotions, I don't want to feel that. And the other thing that I discovered as I went more into my transition over the first 2 and 3 years is all those emotions that I had from, say, my early 20s in the 70s, all the way through my 60s, that was physically ruining my health.
Mm, yes, I can see that. Mind over matter.
It's all those emotions, all those chemicals your body is producing.
Yeah.
They don't do you any bit of good.
No, your immune system gets lowered. Right.
Totally lowered.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was type 2 diabetic from age 38.
Oh, wow.
I had horrible blood work. And by the time I was in my 60s, I was 70 pounds overweight.
Oh, my goodness.
And I didn't care about myself at all. There was no self-acceptance whatsoever and zero self-love. That's where I arrived at my first therapy appointment. 3 months into therapy, my third therapy session, I went against the rules that my wife had established. She said, you can't leave the house as Wendy. You can't go out in a dress. You can't do any of this until you are away and on your own. Okay. Well, my third session, I told her, I'm going as Wendy. Mm. That's something I need to do for me, and that's what I'm doing.
Mm. Gotcha.
I put boundaries in place.
Sure. Sure.
And we got through that, and it was wonderful. It was the first time I ever went out as myself.
Wow, you've overcome that hurdle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hadn't cross-dressed in 35 years at least.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about it. Mm-hmm. At that time, I didn't even know that there was a transgender community.
Right.
This is January of 2015, and I didn't know any transgender people.
So, Wendy, at what point did you start to be introduced to communities such as this and people such, you know, in these communities, to the point where you're not just, you know, receiving as part of that community, but now you make the decision to give and contribute to the community by the work that you're doing now? I mean, and that was 2015 when you're just learning of this.
Right.
So what was the timeline between then and the work you started doing contributing to the community?
It actually, I didn't have the typical belief that is held by a lot of people in the community.
Okay.
Transition is difficult and takes a long time. I didn't have that belief. So therefore, I had no restrictions by it.
Gotcha.
And once I started to see by the third month of therapy, once I started to see that this was possible for me, mm-hmm. I could go out, I can do this.
Yeah.
I am learning how to blend into society as everyday life as any other woman. I can do this.
Right.
So my transition took from living as male to living full-time as female took 6 months.
Wow. That sounds like a land speed record. You know, I mean, it's...
And it had nothing to do with the presentation. Right. I focused that entire time on all what I call the mental work of shifting my beliefs, seeing possibilities, because life is all about possibilities.
Right.
And it's in those beliefs that I talked about earlier, they will mask the possibilities from our view.
Yes, they will. Yeah, they certainly will.
Or sabotage us from being able to achieve them because we don't believe we can achieve them.
Wow.
And that's a point where I see a lot of people that I encounter in the community that I help through their transitions. That's where they're stuck. Mm-hmm. They're stuck in their beliefs.
That is amazing. In fact, you know what? I think you were reading my mind, Wendy, because this may be along the lines of this next question I had for you, which is basically what has been one of the hardest challenges by society that can make your work an uphill battle? And these types of beliefs or restrictions that people put on themselves when they get stuck in this part of the transition sounds like one of those uphill battles.
That is an uphill battle. And when somebody comes to me and wants to get through that, one of the things I do is I make sure they're committed to themselves. Right. I've already been through all of this.
Yeah.
I know how to take them through it too.
Yes.
Yes. And so I start working with them and I hold them to accountability to themselves.
Yeah.
And weekly sessions, they get homework, things that I expect them to work on.
That's right.
And we keep going from there. And the other thing that I did for myself after therapy sessions, both on the way to therapy and on the way home from therapy, is I would give myself little life tests. I would go out in public and do something very simple, just to be seen in public, to be out, to walk down the street, to walk through town, to pretend grocery shop, because you can't go grocery shopping.
Right.
All of those things. And between that and working on my belief structure and seeing possibilities and all of that, you begin to really feel that you can let go and this is possible.
I see.
That's what I assign people to do when they're working with me.
Understood. I mean, this is true work and accountability in which you are coaching and guiding these individuals through. I find it absolutely fascinating, Wendy, because, you know, you do have to put in the work, right?
Right.
As with anything.
It takes about, according to Dr. Joe, and I've seen it happen within 2 to 4 months.
Yeah.
You can completely rewire your brain and shift your belief structures in that short period of time.
Tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. Now, Wendy, with you, one thing that strikes me about you that I feel is quite unique, but I will give you this disclaimer right now. Because I'm not in that community or very knowledgeable of it, I could be wrong, but what makes you very unique to me is you have had a very, I'm going to say, courtside seat view of the way society was, say, 20, 30, 40, 50, well, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. And what was accepted then, what's not accepted then. And now you are doing the work to help coach and guide other people. Here we are in a new century. Here we are in where there's multiple generations beyond yours. Okay. And so this leads me to ask, you know, with the certain changes that have occurred in the world, particularly here in North America, the US, you know, in the past 5 or 10 years, let's say, things like social injustice, broader support of the LGBTQ plus community, and a lot of other things, more awareness to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that sort of thing. Is there any part of your work that is in complete contrast to what you've experienced 30 or 40 years ago that has made your work a lesser challenge than what you endured those years, many years ago?
Nowadays, especially after 2012, a lot of people started really coming out.
Yeah.
It really took off, surprisingly, even to me, during the pandemic. I think it was because people had time to themselves. Yes. They were alone. They were on Zoom.
A lot of time to think too, yeah. So
from here down, they could be whatever they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the thing that a lot of people in the community don't have, and it's basically generational, is an understanding of the history from where we came. Yeah. And what was possible then, mm-hmm. or impossible, and what is possible now. But the one major factor that I find within the community is, again, a lack of understanding about emotionally and mentally transitioning, as well as the physical aspects of it.
Okay. Yeah.
The mental part of it is key. Totally critical to anything mm-hmm. you hope to achieve on the other side of your transition, in terms of blending into society as a woman, blending into society as a man.
Right.
And part of that is, in the process of getting rid of my own beliefs that I couldn't do this, and replacing them with supportive beliefs and emotions and thoughts and everything.
Yeah.
I also had to deconstruct decades of male socialization that I didn't want in the first place,
yeah.
but I was stuck with.
Right.
So right. you have to become very self-aware. Mm-hmm. That's where self-awareness comes in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you have to work on getting rid of those thoughts and beliefs and finding self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. I mean, true self-acceptance as to who you've always been.
Yes.
Because we don't transition to be something we're not.
Right.
We transition to be something we've always been.
Understood. Understood.
And that's something that a lot of my clients go, oh, wow, I never thought of it that way.
See, yeah.
The power of changing thoughts.
Yes. Yes. It's highly impactful. And,
yes.
And it's truly, truly important because, I mean, that's perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's perspective. And speaking of those aha moments, you know, that was one that your clients have revealed to you. From my understanding, your community is a blend of transgenders and cisgender allies and so forth. I was wondering if you could share with us in conversations that you've had with cisgenders, and things that you have explained to them about being born transgender and so forth, has any of them shared with you, you know, after hearing some of these experiences, whether from you or from other transgenders, the aha moment where they finally understood and empathize, that led them to that outlet, almost like that point with your therapist, mm-hmm. where, you know, she turns around and asks, what is your name? And then mm-hmm. crosses out, you know, your male name and puts in Wendy. You know, mm-hmm. What are some of those that maybe cisgenders in the community have shared with you as an aha moment that led them to understand that, hey, they're not doing this for attention. Okay. They were truly born this way scientifically. This is how, you know, how they are.
Well, I'll explain that or comment on that this way.
Okay.
I moved in. I left my house, family, everything behind, moved about 40 miles north to New Hope, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I knew that it was an LGBT-friendly community, very cute little town on the Delaware River in central Bucks County, right across the river from Lambertville, New Jersey. Okay. Beautiful area, lots of and really good people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mixed, cisgender, and a large gay population. Mm-hmm. There was only about maybe 10 or 12 people like myself living around the area full time.
Okay.
And then periodically, people who cross-dress, that's another part of the community, would come into town. So I moved there and I'm thinking, oh, all the gay people are going to understand me. They're going to know all about this. Wrong.
Really?
Yeah. I found flowers at my door my first week there. Welcome to the neighborhood, Chad and Jason, number 15.
Okay.
It was a mixed bag of apartments. I was in a second floor apartment. There was someone below me. There was a couple of condos beside and all of that. Okay.
Yeah.
That kind of, and it was a very social street too, which I found out. I didn't know anything about the place when I moved there.
Interesting. Yeah.
So on a Sunday evening, I saw Chad and Jason came home at about 8:30. I went down to their place at about 9 o'clock on a Sunday evening. They told me, well, there's a running bet in the neighborhood. Are you a cisgender woman or are you one of the cross-dressers that occasionally comes into town and you just decided to live here? And I explained, neither.
Right.
I was born transgender. I'm changing my legal identity. I am going to have surgery to have my birth defect corrected.
Yeah.
Sometime, somewhere, don't know when, but that's going to happen.
Right, right.
And I followed that up with, you can, I'm an open book. Ask me anything you want to, and absolutely nothing is off limits. Mm-hmm. That is the first time I ever said that to another person.
Amazing.
And I said it to these two gay gentlemen.
Yeah.
Jason looked at me and said, you shouldn't have said that in front of Chad. And he asked me everything. We talked from 9 o'clock on a Sunday evening until about 3:30 Monday morning.
Oh, my. Wow.
They were mind blown.
Yeah.
And so was I. And I left that going, wow, this is great.
Both sides have learned from this experience, this conversation.
I have had so much fun with this.
Yeah.
Talking to them and explaining and telling them about my life. And then I'd hear about theirs.
Yes.
And there was more commonality than not.
Isn't that amazing?
As I went forward a little bit more, I found out that if I went to the Raven, which was the big gay bar in town, and a big bar, at about 3 to 4 in the afternoon, I could sit there at the bar and talk with gay men, gay women, occasionally straight women and straight men who came to the bar. And that's where I actually started doing what I'm doing today, having conversations with people. And I would look the gay men especially, and you knew you were gay at an early age. Oh yeah, childhood. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And you knew it was wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Parents made that abundantly clear. And okay, so you drank the Kool-Aid. You had a career, you had a wife, you had a house, you had a family, you did the whole thing, and you were miserable. Yeah. And you came out. Yep. And now you're here with me. Yeah. Mm. The only difference between you and me is you became a G, I became a T.
I see. That's it. Yeah. Amazing.
Now, first Christmas, my most wonderful Christmas ever. Beautiful progressive dinner party going through the entire neighborhood. Each apartment and condo served a course.
Yeah.
At the end of that evening, I'm sitting talking to now my friend David.
Yeah.
Of Tom and David.
Right.
And we're sitting there talking. It's about 2 a.m. The party's winding down finally.
Yeah.
And I'm talking with him and I'm seeing tears running down his face. And I said to him, "What's wrong?" He goes, "Wen, I have to apologize to you." I said, "For what?" "You've been great." He said, "Ever since I met you, I've been rethinking everything I understand about people like you. You've been so open, so vulnerable, and you've shared so every aspect of your life and pretty much hid nothing." Mm. He said, "That has made such a tremendous difference for all of us." Mm. And he said, "I apologize for all the horrible thoughts I had about people like you."
Oh.
This is coming from a gay man.
Wow.
I walked over. I got off my stool. I walked over. I hugged him, kissed him on both cheeks, and said, "You're fine. We're friends."
Nice.
He still stays in touch. He's in North Central Pennsylvania now, and I'm here in Rhode Island.
Yep.
He called me 2 weeks ago on a Saturday night, and we talked for an hour and a half. Again, he told me, "When you made my life 1,000 times better by knowing you."
Mm.
"I look at other people who are different, and I don't see them the same way anymore."
And you started that just by being who you are. You've set a tremendous example to all the people you've encountered on your path by being open, being vulnerable, being that open book. And that I have to really commend you for, Wendy. It's an enormous example that a lot of people should, you know, take to heart and try to demonstrate themselves when interacting with people. Could you tell us about your podcast, Demystifying the Transgender Journey?
Well, the other thing that I've found out all the way through the last 10 years of my living authentically as myself, not only has my health improved, my blood work comes back perfect all the time. I'm no longer diabetic and I dropped the 70 pounds. And
it's wonderful.
In my 70s now, I can walk anywhere between 3 and 6 miles a day just for exercise.
That's amazing. That is so impressive.
And I believe the universe set me on this path in 2015 to be the person to be out there, to be open with people. So I decided in 2022, I was sick and tired of hearing all the BS on the news about people like me.
Right.
From political people, from religious people, from society as a whole, putting out all this crap about who we are.
Yeah.
So I decided I'm going to find a new platform. I was only doing my coaching work. I was only on social media.
Yeah.
And I had the opportunity in 2023 to start podcast guesting. I hired an agency, Interview Connections, and started on this journey. I knew nothing about podcasting. And the first host to interview me was Christine Blasdale in Australia. She used to be an FM radio personality, interviewing people on FM radio in LA at a radio station there. Oh, she did that for 20 years.
Very nice.
So I felt privileged to be interviewed by her.
Of course.
On her podcast. Wow.
Yes.
And what I found out was she had tears running down her eyes the entire time she was interviewing me.
Oh, my.
And we've really become quite good. We've stayed in touch. Everything's been fine. I've learned so much from her.
Oh, that is great.
But she encouraged me. She said to me right away, she said, "Wendy, you need your own podcast."
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't ready for it at the time. I didn't know anything. I hadn't been through this.
Right.
I joined her. She has a mastermind program. So I joined her mastermind. She teaches podcasting, content reuse, media editing, all of that stuff.
Yep.
And I introduced myself to the group. Now it's a mixed bag of Australians and Americans. And I just put it all out there. Lynn Murphy, one of the other members, unmuted and said, "Wendy, I need to talk to you." Mm-hmm. Chris told her what a great interview it was, blah, blah, blah. And we went from there. I talked with her a couple of times in November. We got to know each other. Lynn and I started recording for a chapter in her book, because she had written the book, Life Lessons of 50 Inspiring Women.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So her publisher wanted her to do a second book, second edition of the book, only this time include some diversity.
Sure.
I'm diversity.
That makes sense. I got you.
And one thing led to another, and Lynn is the most wonderful, open-minded, caring, curious, cisgender, hetero woman who knew very little about the LGBT community.
Right, right.
And we just kept talking and talking. The first interview lasted 4 hours. And she didn't even get to any of her questions. It just evolved. And by the spring of 2024, we did an agreement to co-host Demystifying the Transgender Journey, a name I hallucinated in the winter of 2024 one Saturday night while I was just relaxing watching TV.
Oh, sure. By the way, I love the name because it just point blank tells you what it's about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't beat around the bush at all.
No. You know?
Yeah, it gets straight to the point, and there's a need for that.
And transgender people have joined the community that I've started around the podcast.
Good.
And transgender people can learn a lot from the interviews we do and from the episodes we're posting and all of that. But the primary target of the audience of it is cisgender people.
Interesting. They want to learn.
The community that I'm forming, I also have some transgender people have joined me in that.
Right, right.
But it's for people to have conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what I want to do is take what I have done from 2015 and all the way forward, talking to people and just put it out there in a much bigger platform. Podcast that I'm co-hosting with Lynn, and a community that we meet monthly. And I just want cisgender people to come in there, whether they have transgender people in their family, relatives, in their community, or coworkers, or anyone that they are curious about, but they're afraid to ask the questions.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm abundantly clear on that. Ask what you want to ask. Don't worry about how you phrase it. If I know that it would be potentially offensive or hurtful to someone else to ask it that way, I'll tell you the correct way to ask the question.
Exactly. As long as it's genuine, authentic, and comes from the heart. Right. Right.
Yeah. And the particular difficulty that I also see and I've experienced within my own community is a lot of people don't like to talk to cisgender people and explain themselves. They feel like they're being put under a microscope. They feel like they have to justify themselves.
I see. Yeah.
All of that. So I encourage people to do it if they're comfortable and if they're open to it. But you have to be open.
You have to be open, and not everyone is ready at the same time.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, that makes so much sense, Wendy. So let's say the listeners want to be a part of this community, whether they're cisgender listeners or transgender listeners, the listeners want to be a part of this community. How can they connect with you? How can they connect and be a part of the community and learn more about the great work that you're doing?
Well, to protect the community also, which is kind of important
nowadays. Oh, very important. Absolutely. Yes.
I'm keeping it fairly closed.
Understood.
And I'll give you a link to put in the show notes that goes to a page where people can register.
Yep.
Subscribe to the newsletter, because the newsletter by the same name, Demystifying the Transgender Journey, is how I communicate with people. It's how I communicate about our activities and what we're doing.
Oh, that's great.
So it's important that they sign up for that.
Yes.
And I also give them the option on that page as well to schedule a 5 to 10 minute phone call or a short Zoom session with me, just to ask some questions about the community, get some clarification on how the meetings are conducted and all of that. And also to give them a sense that I'm trying to make it secure and a safe environment. I also want parents of transgender to come in, and I do work with parents of transgender people as well, because parents have no framework for any of this either.
Right.
When their child tells them at any age, whether it's 10, 12, 15, 25, or 45, they still have no framework for this.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I provide for them. I can do that in coaching sessions where they can join the community and come to the community meetings and ask their questions and get information there and follow what's going on. And I'll give you the link to the webpage, and you can put that in the show notes.
Absolutely. We will definitely put that in the show notes. And Wendy, I want to specifically thank you for that clarification on working with parents of transgender children as well, right? It goes beyond just working with adults, but born transgender starts at childhood. So
exactly.
So it only makes sense to extend to parents of transgender children.
I've written an article that PFLAG published for parents of transgender, and that inspired me to start a book on that, which I did. And I got the edits back and I started working on them, but then I shifted away from that to work on the podcast and everything else.
Yeah.
And I'm back into working on the edits so I can get it to my publisher and get the book out. The working title is Love Knows No Gender.
Gotcha.
Parenting a Transgender Child.
Gotcha. I like the name of that title too. It just goes right between the eyes and tells you what it is. So
that's my thing.
Yeah, it truly is, Wendy. And you have a lot of exciting initiatives and projects going on. And the community and the listeners here, we just can't wait to see these be provided, right? And served out into the world for those who are looking for that support, looking for that help. Wendy, I really have to thank you for coming on the show.
to connect with me too, Aubrey?
Yes, yes.
Directly, meetwendycole.com.
Meetwendycole.com.
That's it.
All right. We're going to put that on the episode show notes as well, as many links as we can, so that people can learn about your great work, subscribe to your newsletter, maybe set up a time to chat with you for a few minutes to answer any questions that they may have and that they have been afraid to ask. I truly hope for all the listeners' sake, after hearing this conversation, that any questions you have that you are apprehensive to ask, that this has helped you build some assurance in asking, as long as it's genuine and authentic and comes from the heart. And it's not to mean or be derogatory, right? It's not meant to be mean-spirited, but it's mm-hmm. coming from a true place of just authenticity and love. Wendy, thank you so, so much for coming on the show. I truly, truly appreciate you. And I hope we can stay in touch and maybe have you on the show in the future.
Absolutely. I would love that. And we will stay in touch. Definitely.
Fantastic. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And hey, look, you may think at times that in our daily struggles and adversities that that we're alone. When the truth is, you know, we're never alone. And hope is just around the corner. I humbly ask that you please share this show with someone you know, someone you love, who needs motivation, inspiration, and support. And you know, when it comes down to it, we're all just roadies on this journey of life. But it sure feels good having you alongside with me on the road. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Road to Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.